This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Navy SEAL veteran and One More Wave team member, Rob Garnett. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Rob's exposure to surfing as a child, his journey into the military, his experience both pre and post 9/11, kindness on the battlefield, his unique perspective on service, helping the adaptive athlete, mental health, the healing power of surfing, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So that being said, I introduce to you Rob Garnett. Enjoy. Well, Rob, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Absolutely, James. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I am in San Diego, California. So the southernmost part of Southern California.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your timeline. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Sure. So now I'm from Southern California. I was born in Southern California and then bounced around all over the place. My my parents divorced pretty early on. So I was bouncing between, you know, mother and father's house in Southern California. And then my mom moved to Northern California, which is much different, much more rural. And so we stayed up there until probably I was finishing, you know, high school for, so probably 16, 17, we moved back down to Southern California and really got back into the water. That's where I kind of got reconnected with getting back into surfing and everything to do with the ocean. Finished up school and went into college, lasted for less than a year before I dropped out of college, and ended up going to school to be a commercial diver for a little bit. Did that for a little bit, wasn't really working for me, and that's what led me to join the Navy.
What about profession? What were your parents doing?
My mother was worked at a grocery store, and my father was a roofer, so he's a tradesman.
Did you have any military members in the extended family at that time?
No, not really. I had a grandfather that served in Korea in the U.S. Army, but that was really it. No cousins, no friends or relatives really that I was close with that had that served in the military.
So how young were you when you first, you know, did the aquatic sports, and then when did that end? When did you go north?
We did lots of aquatics early on. My mom was very into making sure we were water safe because we were always at the beach. And so we learned to swim very early, and then we did competitive swimming and then later water polo all through school. So we were always very comfortable in the water, and then lots and lots of time in the ocean and then in the lakes and rivers up in Northern California.
And were you surfing as a young child, or was that something you actually got into later?
No, I did. I started surfing in probably middle school. So 10, 11, 12, I think is when I started doing some surfing. We did a couple trips to Hawaii, really got hooked and some good instruction out there. And that's what kind of led me to keep going with it.
When you look back now, and the reason I ask this, when those of us in uniform start having some sort of mental health challenge, the mistake is to just look at, well, you were in Fallujah, you were at the 9/11, whatever the acute event was, in uniform. And there's a kind of disregarding of what happened to us from birth, or arguably even in vitro, forward to when we ever put the uniform on in the first place. When you reflect back now at your early life, were there any contributing factors to struggles that you maybe had later on?
For sure. I think just having your parents split up is pretty traumatic. And then, my father was pretty abusive to my mother. So all that stuff, I'm sure, affected me at a very young age and set me on the path to some mental health struggles later on. Absolutely.
Would you say that also sent you into the protector role as well? Maybe having seen, people that are vulnerable and feeling like you wanted to be the protector one day?
Absolutely. Yeah. Seeing those things happen in your home for sure kind of keys you up to notice it other places for sure.
What about career aspirations? What were you dreaming of becoming when you were in high school?
I just wanted to do something around the ocean. I just loved the idea of being able to do something on the water. And so when I went to college, to university, I thought, I'd do some type of oceaneering, some type of oceanography type stuff. And so that's what I thought I was going to go do.
I think there's a lot of marine biologists that never finished up in the States, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We all thought we were going to work at SeaWorld and train the dolphins.
Absolutely. And then you find out that dolphins actually aren't very happy anyway. So there we go.
No, exactly.
All right. Well, then walk me through into commercial diving. I think this is one of the interesting things for a lot of people listening. Arguably, I've got a college education, but it was a trade school that sent me into the actual profession that I adored. So how did you find diving, and what did you find? What were your experiences in that world specifically?
Sure. Well, I was going to school for university up in Long Beach, California, which is a big kind of longshoreman and lots of commercial diving, lots of shipping and all kinds of things like that. So that was just something I was drawn to. I was still really drawn to the ocean. So I thought, hey, I can go to this trade. And so I went to this school also in Long Beach, California, and there was choices with the become a commercial diver. You could become a medical person, maybe like an EMT that would help run the hyperbaric chamber, take care of the folks that are diving. You could become an inspector. You might go underneath the ships or oil platforms and inspect what it looked like, or you could become a welder and actually be the person doing it. So the medical thing kind of spoke to me. So I became a med tech. So I went through the process of, learning all those skill sets to run the hyperbaric chambers. You also become a commercial diver, but then went through some EMT training. So I had that medical training and then finished the school. I think it was about 3 or 4 months. I can't really remember. And then I was placed. They were pretty good about placing you at a job. And so I went right to an oil platform in Galveston, Texas. And when I got there, I just realized that it was really hard work, a lot of roughnecks. It's really just a construction site, but on the water. It's not any different than roofing or laying brick or any other hard physical labor. But what I noticed was I wasn't allowed to dive. When you're new, you're just kind of holding the hose for the more senior guys. And when you make money, the money we all think you make when you're commercial diving, it's when you're diving, not when you're holding the hose. So I was making minimum wage and really unable to pay my student loans. And so that made me kind of start looking for other ways to make some money.
I've had a couple of interactions with people that work the platforms, and that, to be completely fair, it's almost like a belittling of trying to make an impact on the firefighter work week. Because, our men and women in uniform work 56 hours. They work 80 hours if they're forced to a day of overtime. And there's no kind of, badge of honor with that. It breaks down the body, it breaks down the mind. But a lot of the kind of poo-pooing came from, well, I worked in the oil platforms and you know, and we were fine. So it's kind of an interesting perspective. What did you see as far as the physical and mental health of the people that were working on the platforms? Is it an old school kind of attitude to maybe something that needs to be more progressive as well?
It was incredibly old school, just kind of let's just get to work. If you were hurt, you're supposed to work. Everyone, as soon as everyone got off, it was just a kind of a big drinking fest. Everyone would drink until it was time to go to work and then just do that over and over again. And just no one really cared about anyone else, to be honest. It's just like, hey, let's get up and get working and get some hours and then go back. So I'm sure it's a place where they could use lots of kind of revamping for how they kind of handle each other.
Absolutely. That's the impression I got, at least from these two gentlemen that gave me the honor of their feedback. So what about the transition into the Navy then? What made you decide to go in the uniform?
Sure. Funny enough, so I would get these notices because I wasn't paying my student loans. I'd get these notices that said, hey, you're late. We're going to, you know, send the guys to come collect. And I looked on the back of these notices I kept getting. It was like ways to defer student loans. And one of them was to join the service. And so I was like, okay, I can do this. It'll get me away from it for a little bit. And that's what led me to join the Navy. So I joined the Navy. I went into the Navy recruiting office to figure out what I was going to do. And I really thought that I could go be a commercial diver in the Navy. I thought I could be a Navy diver. But hey, I've already done this. I've already got these certifications. They should let me in. And they flat out told me, no, it wasn't open. I wasn't going to be able to do that. But they said, hey, there's this other, you know, field that you could try out for where they do diving. And they pointed me towards BUDS, towards SEAL training. And that's how I joined the Navy. And that was really my path to going at all, was to stop the bleeding and figure out a way to pay my student loans.
With the background of surfing, water polo, and then commercial diving, I would make an assumption, knowing, you know, somewhat about, you know, what BUDS looks like and the training and the confidence and, you know, the entanglements and all these different drills that you guys do, that would have served you well. How did it actually serve you when you were in the program?
You're right. I was comfortable in the water. It's still a shock. It's still challenging. But for example, I met guys that I showed up to training with that had never even seen the ocean before, that had made it through the selection process and had been through boot camp and a couple other, you know, things to be able to get to BUDS, and they had never seen the ocean. So I definitely felt like I had a leg up, and I was already a strong swimmer. I'd been swimming my whole life. So for me to get into the water and swim, when we had swimming, we call them evolutions, in BUDS, it was kind of a break. I'd say, okay, good. I know I can be out here and no one's going to mess with me, and I'm confident in the water. So absolutely all that water time as a kid and growing up was beneficial.
What about the mindset side? I know I've had many, many members of the SEAL community on here now, and there is no kind of super soldier prototype. And, you know, more often than not, they're not the big, you know, gorilla type lads. But over and over again, there's usually such a strong why behind their story of how they continued and other people rang the bell. So you've got the aquatic confidence, but obviously there's just that insane suffering. There's the insane cold. What was it that kept you going and not becoming one of the attrition statistics?
For sure. So the attrition was really high when I went to BUDS. So I was the early 90s. And so the Navy and Naval Special Warfare were trying some different programs to kind of figure out, hey, how can we get more people to be successful and not attrite from training? So they sent several of us as like a pilot course to a couple of SEAL units before we ever went. And the thought was, if you're around these guys and you see that they're just regular humans, they're not, like you said, these superhumans that we kind of have these ideas about, then maybe you'd be more inclined to not quit. And so I went to a SEAL unit in Puerto Rico and stayed there for, I think, 4 or 5 months, just training and, you know, being hazed by the guys all the time as each group would come through. And so what I found was that, you know, all that was rough and it got me ready to go, but I didn't have a really good family background. My mom was great, but like, I didn't really have a lot of family that I could go to. And so when I saw these guys, I'm like, oh man, these guys, they get to go on these great trips together. They have these amazing adventures and they've all been through this, whatever it is, together. And I wanted that. I thought, oh man, this is like, you know, these guys they're like rock stars. They get to travel around. They get to do what they'd want to do. They stay together all the time. And they seemed to really enjoy life. And I thought, oh, I really want that. And so that really inspired me. I go, I want to be that. I want to be a part of this group. I want to have friends like this. These guys all talked about how they'd been friends for 10, 15 plus years, living in the SEAL teams. And I thought, oh, that's something I want. And so when I was lucky enough to then go to Buds after that, I knew I was like, I want to get to a team. I've seen these guys. I know that I think I can do it. And so that was a big motivator for me, was to get through it and catch back up with some of these people and, you know, be able to experience what they described every time they came through to do training.
I know you entered quite a few years before 9/11. So what was the, the kind of training environment? Were they still kind of in that more kind of Vietnam mindset that you hear some of the older SEALs being experienced with? And, you know, what was that transition then? You know, what was the 9/11 switch for you personally?
For sure. It was interesting. When I first got to my first SEAL team on the West Coast, there was two Vietnam guys that were at the team. They'd been around for a long time. Both of them had broken service, meaning they'd gotten out and come back in. And so a lot of the training that happened was still very much based on Vietnam. Now, there'd been some other things that have popped up since then. You know, obviously there'd been people had gone to Grenada, people had gone to Panama, and there'd been a couple other little things, but nothing really happened until 1993 when Somalia started getting really hot. And so when I checked in my first team, there were people still coming back from operations in Somalia. And so that was a big change for us, was just in, you know, 1995, when I got to the team, people were still going to Somalia and Mogadishu. And we were switching then from the kind of Vietnam style of operating into what they had seen in the cities of Mogadishu. And so that was a big change. Just while I was there, I watched things kind of change. And then, like you mentioned, it changed again when 9/11 happened and we started deploying in much larger numbers.
So pre 9/11, where did you find yourself, you know, roughly deployed? Like which kind of corners of the world?
Each of the teams at that time were regionally aligned, and so I started with SEAL Team 3, and so our main area was the Middle East, and so we would go to places like Bahrain or Kuwait or Jordan, all these countries that we kind of had relationships with, and so we'd go train with their folks. It was supposed to be cross training, but really it was always just us training them, and then we'd run into our SBS friends when we get there, and we'd all train everybody together. But it was really just all those kind of more friendly to Western folks countries. And we would just go on deployment. We'd stay there for several months, do exercises, bounce around, do training, and then come back. It was definitely not as focused as it became after 9/11.
Was there any sense pre, when you look back now, of something like maybe not even the terrorist attack, but ultimately ending back in Iraq and Afghanistan back then, or was it more of a status quo?
It was more of a status quo. It was just, hey, we go over, we do some training, we come back. You know, early on, I think the first thing I kind of remember where we were doing real stuff was when we had embargoes with Iraq, and Saddam Hussein was still trying to make some money, so they would smuggle oil and dates and all kinds of things, and all of us NATO countries would kind of hop on and do these ship interdictions where we'd stop the boats, kind of turn them back over and try to stop the flow of illegal smuggling that was happening. But really, until that was really the only thing we did, we'd do some shipboardings and we'd all rotate between us, the Brits, the Danes, the Poles, whoever happened to be rotating, boarding these ships out in the Arabian Gulf. And nothing really happened again aside from that. And that was kind of small until 9/11 happened. And then, you know, obviously Afghanistan and then Iraq.
So talk to me about 9/11 that day through your eyes.
Sure. I was actually a Buds instructor. So I had rotated from being on a SEAL team, and I was working in Coronado as a Buds instructor. And we were just a regular day, and then all of a sudden it's on the news, and quite shocking, obviously. We all kind of remember where we were on that day, but I distinctly remember coming into work and one of the towers had already been hit, and then watching the other one be hit on TV, sitting in our instructor office in the back, and just that training had stopped, that we made sure everyone could reach out to their families. I remember distinctly there's some dudes that were in class and had family in New York. So we were making sure that everyone could reach out and at least kind of figure out what was happening. But for everybody, for the whole world, it was pretty shocking for sure.
Absolutely. Now, from a training point of view, not specifics, but a lot of times, you know, when something like this happens, everything shifts. There's a kind of scrambling to catch up. And then sadly, obviously, learning lessons from the people that are coming home. What was that kind of training curve from this Vietnam era with a sprinkling of Somalia to now you're in two arenas within a couple of years of each other?
Learning to, one of the big things obviously was everyone was worried about chemical weapons. And so the ramp up of training with wearing all that stuff all the time, was crazy. There was so much of it. We'd spend weeks out in the desert doing all that, using it with vehicles. So that was a big one. Another thing that really changed for us from Vietnam on, when SEALs deployed, they'd deploy in a platoon, which was typically 16 people. When the war started, we would start deploying with what we called a troop, which was three platoons. And now we're getting up into upwards of 50 to 70 guys. And then entire teams would deploy. We'd start to call them squadrons. And so when it was time for your team to deploy, the entire team would deploy, not just a small group with maybe an O2 or an O3 in charge. It would be the whole command would go. So you'd have 300 plus people would go and deploy. And so that was big change for us. We never operated in big, large numbers. We became more like a Ranger battalion with these big giant groups of people going and doing big movements that the SEALs had not done before. And so that was a big change, was those larger numbers and a lot of the biochemical threat training. Those are the two big ones that really, I remember distinctly that it was a different and kind of new thing that we were doing.
And did you find yourself coming out of BUDS and going back into the deployments?
I did. And so when 9/11 happened, they actually told us that, I remember the headshed of the command of BUDS, of what we call the center. They said, hey, if you want to go back now, you can get out early. You can leave your rotation time. You know, typically it was 3 years. You could leave early. And so me and a couple of guys, we just left and went back to the teams. And so I went and immediately went back to a team in the hopes of deploying.
And where did you find yourself deployed? Was it Iraq or Afghanistan?
Both. Went right back into a team. It was kind of shocking because I was in groups that were deploying with people that had come through, with guys that had been through training when I was an instructor. Now I was in a platoon with them, and we were all, you know, going to war together. So it was definitely surreal to be like, hey, I was just, you know, facilitating this training for guys, and now I'm in it with them, and we're all going together. So not something I'd experienced before, obviously, but everyone was very, you know, at that time, everyone was super patriotic. Doesn't matter what country you're from, we're like, hey, we're going to do this thing and get rid of these bad guys. And so whether it was Afghanistan or Iraq, everyone kind of felt the same, not quite the same vitriol everyone had when he went to Afghanistan, but similar for both places.
There's a question I always ask anyone who's been deployed, and the backstory is simply, in America especially, we get a very polarized view of war. Either kill them all, let God sort them out, stack the bodies, or they're all baby killers, you know. And in the middle are the men and women that we send with our flag on their shoulder to go and protect, you know, the innocence of another country. Was there a moment, regardless of the politics, aside from the politics, where you witnessed with your own eyes that there were some horrific people that needed to be taken care of?
Absolutely. Especially, and more so, I didn't see this as much in Iraq, but Afghanistan, the people that would hurt kids, that was a big thing, especially young boys. It's really hard to not want to, you know, serve some justice for the way that they would treat. I mean, when you just see the big trucks, the Jenga trucks, we call them, with all the decoration on them, and you'd see a guy driving with a young boy, and you'd go, I remember when I first got there, I thought, oh, they're just, that's cool. You know, the dad's taking the son with them and they're just out working. But that wasn't the case at all. That was their person that they were going to just pass around when they went to different spots. And that part really, it's really hard, and it's really dug deep into that culture. So it's really hard to look someone in the face and talk seriously with them when you know that's what's going on. So those people are evil for sure.
One of my friends actually was just talking the other day on an interview, and we were talking about moral injury. And he was, you know, deployed in the Middle East during that time. And he used that very example. I think it was either, you know, an abusive husband or even that kind of element. And as you said, his hands were tied. And so you're there to be a protector, but you're kind of, you know, the rules and regulations that you work under, you're not actually able to do the human thing, the ethical thing, which is to stop certain things from happening. And this is, you know, I think the inability to say, the inability to protect, it's not PTSD, it's the moral injury side, which can be equally detrimental.
No, for sure. And I think it's lucky for us in the special operation, doesn't matter where you were, we didn't have to experience as much as the regular folks, the regular infantry folks, the regular Marines, they just had to stand and deal with that constantly. For us, I think we saw it rarely compared to everybody else, but the impact of that is horrific, as you're saying.
Well, the other side of the question that we also never hear really on the news is the kindness and compassion that I've heard over and over again in some of these combat zones. So when you reflect, what were some of the moments of kindness that you remember?
In almost every country I've ever been, when you're in some type of a bad situation, it's always amazing, you know, whether it's Kenya or in Ramadi, when you need some help, regular people want to help other humans. I distinctly being in long protracted gunfights and having men and women come out and give us water or something to eat that are there also, or offering to help or calling other people or wanting to tell you when bad things are about to happen. That happened so many times. It was quite amazing for sure.
Absolutely. Well, as you progress through, I mean, you know, I know we're going to talk about obviously one more wave and helping our veterans, but I don't really know much about your own specific journey. So did you start having any struggles yourself as you progressed through your career?
I did. I think for us, it was really easy to just keep deploying all the time. For the SEAL teams, there's West Coast teams and East Coast teams. They're all in the same street. And so you just move from team to team. And so during when the wars were really hot and heavy, every team always needed more people, whether it's because they just needed more people or someone had gotten injured or hurt or couldn't deploy. And so you could just go and go and go. And so I think what happened to a lot of us is you just kept doing it over and over and over again. And so you don't take care of yourself. You don't pay attention to when you go on deployment, you know, you kind of become one person. And when you come back, you kind of try to switch back to being an at-home person. And eventually those just become the same person. And so I didn't really realize how much that impacted me until I stopped deploying. I had gotten injured in a pretty good IED at the end and ended up having to go spend some time at Bethesda Medical Hospital. And so when I went, what led up to that was me at home just not being able to do a lot of things, not being able to relax, not being able to sleep, being angry all the time, drinking too much, getting into the thing that a lot of us do, which is, you know, drinking mixed with nicotine, just rotating those back and forth to make it through the day and then not being able to sleep. And so all those things together really happened to me at the end of my time, just because I think I wasn't busy. I wasn't deploying. And so right at the end, when I retired from the service, from the Navy, I got divorced that same year and kind of had to reset myself. So I know it's the same story that many of us tell, but I think for me, like you, to go back to your question, I started noticing when I stopped deploying all the time and stopped being busy, I took a job so that I could kind of hang out and be engaged with my family. And that's when I realized I was a mess.
A lot of people obviously get to a very, very dark place. And, you know, thank God a lot of ones that have been on here found that light right before it was too late. Where was the darkest place you found yourself?
When I just realized that I didn't even know my family. I deployed so much and been gone. I'd missed so much. I'd grown away from my then wife years and years ago. And we're just doing it because I think we thought we were supposed to. And I was just miserable. The thing that I think crushed me the most was not being able to sleep. And so I was just angry all the time, very short tempered, and just miserable all the time. And I couldn't figure out what it was, whether it's migraines, which would come on, just inability to concentrate. But, just for me, it was like, all of a sudden I'm by myself. I'm like, oh, okay, I gotta figure this out.
I think there's such a jarring element to the transition. It can be military, it can be first responders, but you know, you have, and you touched on it. I think this is one of the unspoken elements, the busyness, the adrenaline, the stress, the excitement of some of these professions. At the beginning, it doesn't matter what void you've got in your life, you can just fill it with that career. You know, all these calls that we go on as firefighters, you're not thinking about, you know, your early life, for example. But as you progress in, you know, if you find yourself deliberately taking overtime or more deployments, and, you know, maybe reflecting back, there's a reason why you're not allowing yourself to have that time to think. Now you get to the transition and you've got people who had this, you know, incredible tribe, you know, the shared suffering that you find in some of these, you know, uniform professions really binds us together. You've got the identity. I'm a SEAL. I'm a firefighter. You've got the purpose. Every day you wake up, you're truly trying to make the world better. And then one day, as you said, so many people are divorced and they find themselves alone in the home, and that can be absolutely crushing. So what was next for you? How did you navigate out of that jarring place that you found yourself?
Well, I was lucky. There was towards the end of that time, my time in, I think the military was getting really good, at least here in the US, at kind of providing a million different types of therapies, finding stuff that maybe everyone was into, whether it's art, music, outdoor hunting, hiking, backpacking, all kinds of different sports, and surfing was one of them. And so the main hospital here in Southern California for veterans called Balboa Naval Hospital San Diego, they had a surf clinic. And so they were teaching actually severely wounded, you know, veterans of all the services, how to surf or how to get back into surfing post injury. And so me and a couple buddies, we can talk about later, Alex and another guy, Kyle, that kicked off when we're away. We were all volunteering when we were active duty ourselves. And so we would volunteer at this surf clinic, helping other people surf. And that's what really kicked it in for me. I realized how much I enjoyed volunteering and helping other people. And, you know, it's just like other things. I think what it did is it took my mind off myself. I could now go back to focusing on something else. This is just like it was when I was in the teams. I could focus on the mission and, you know, people that worked for me or that I worked for or whatever it was. Now I could focus on something else and help these guys and gals do something I loved, which was really everything in the ocean. And so that's when I really realized that volunteering was going to really help me. And I really just dove in and tried to do that a lot.
So talk to me then about the genesis of One More Wave.
Sure. So Alex, myself, and another guy, Kyle. So Alex and I had been friends. We had served together in the 90s on SEAL Team 3. And Alex was starting One More Wave. And the way One More Wave started was we were all volunteering at the surf clinic, and a friend of ours came through the program. He was an Air Force person. He was a below-the-knee amputee, and he was just having a really hard time getting back into surfing after his injury. And so got that board made for him and kind of got hooked. We thought, hey, we're just going to keep doing this. And so Alex is a talented artist. He started making t-shirts. And so we were selling t-shirts out of the back of his truck to try to offset making some of these boards. And we kept doing that for a little bit. And so the only boards we made were adaptive surfboards at first. And that was for people with pretty severe physical injuries. Maybe they need to put handles on the deck of the surfboard or moving things around for injuries, fixing the deck for someone that's got a prosthetic, whatever it might be. And luckily, Starbucks has a documentary crew. They heard about us and came and did a quick documentary on One More Wave. And that's really what kind of exploded us into a lot more people realizing that that was something they could go do. People wanted to volunteer, people wanted to donate. And so that's what really kind of propelled One More Wave into another level of, hey, we need to hire one of us now. We're all doing this after work. And so luckily I had already retired. I was doing some government contracting. And so I was in between contracts. And so luckily we hired me. And so in 2017, I came on with One More Wave, and I've been doing it ever since. But it all started with us working with a naval hospital.
I had a guy on the show, English guy, actually, Tom Hewitt, who lives in South Africa. And he was a high level surfer himself, but he mm-hmm. started seeing all these street kids, these homeless children. I think it was around Durban, if I've got that right. And mm-hmm. so he started a nonprofit called Surfers Not Street Children. And it was really interesting to hear them talking about it. Firstly, they had a lot of these kids were terrified of the ocean because, you know, I think the non-African people have been telling them there's monsters in the sea and don't go in, which there are, you know, in South Africa, but, you know, dissuaded to the point where I think maybe they were trying to keep the beaches for certain groups of people. You know, you've got them getting the confidence back, learning how to swim. Now they're learning to surf, and you got some of to the point where they're on the World Surf League, some of these kids. Amazing. But what was really interesting was he said they would do the session first. So they've got, you know, the ocean, they've got the sunlight, they've got the physical exertion. And then after the sessions, they'd sit on the sand and they'd basically give the kids unofficial counseling therapy. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing as far as the mental health element of this surfing experience that these veterans are going through?
I think it does a couple of things. So I tell people all the time, when you get in the ocean does not care. It does not care if you're having a bad day, if you had a bad day at home, if you're arguing with your spouse, if it's cold, if it's raining. So it forces you to focus. And so that focus lets you either focus on yourself or focus on surfing or something else. And I think it kind of lets your brain heal. And so what it does is it kind of gives you this new purpose of surfing. And then what we found is what people love is the community piece. And so just getting together, and now we've got monthly meetups where we meet all over the US to meet to surf. And all we do is we put up a tent, we get a permit from the beach for 4 hours, and we just meet and surf. And we used to try to add a whole bunch of things to it. We'd say, hey, let's have meals and coffee and yoga, stretching. Maybe it's faith-based in the beginning or after. And what we found is people would come and skip portions of things that they didn't like. And what we realized is that everyone just wanted to, one, meet with a bunch of other people that they felt like they had something in common with, have some coffee and talk a little trash, and then get in the water. And so that's what we really cut out, was to do that. And now we find that people come and they just love to kind of be there, be around, maybe not even get in the water, just might come hang out. Now we do have therapists that will come, but it's not to do anything other than they like to surf too, and they're also veterans. And so it's amazing because what the VA does here in San Diego, which I'm not sure if they do in other cities yet, is they'll actually go do their therapy sessions in the water. If the person surfs, they'll paddle out with them and go surf and have their therapy session in the water. So I think all of that is incredibly therapeutic. I think what it turns into almost is an unled kind of group therapy session. Everyone's out in the water. People might share something. They may not. They might just have some peace for a couple hours, you know, away from everything else. And so I think it's incredibly powerful. We've been lucky enough to have many, many of these groups. And some of them are probably, in San Diego is our largest group. And most of the time is probably 60% veterans. And the rest are first responders, you know, people with no connection to any type of service, just people that want to come surf. And it just brings a really big group of people together. It's been really incredible. On both coasts, Oahu, we even have a group in Okinawa. And people just come to surf, have some unhealthy snacks, you know, some donuts or something and some coffee, and then go surf. And that seems to be what resonates for our groups the most, is to keep it incredibly simple, just bring people together. And it really has made a lot of great connections.
How are you able to help people with the identity piece? I think service is definitely, you know, a huge part. I would argue, I talk about the yin yang a lot. You know, the yang mm-hmm. is the black, which is actually the soft, and the yin is the white. And kind of our generation collectively were raised on the Rambos and the Terminators and, you know, these false right. images of masculinity. And then you become a firefighter or a SEAL, and you know, you identify with this as what I am. And then by the time you come out the other side, rather than a yin yang, you're a white circle now. You're all hard and mm-hmm. no, you know, but it was compassion and empathy really that sent you into service in the first place. So it seems mm-hmm. like one of the real realities is when you come out, like I know guys that went into finance and they just imploded because it wasn't fulfilling at all. You had these people, you know, doing right. arguably the opposite of service. So what are you seeing, you know, with some of these veterans, especially doing the transition, being able to refine who they are rather than what they did?
I think getting in these groups and seeing what other folks are successful with. And when there's some guys that really like to, now that they've come into the group, kind of mentor the newer folks that come in and out, especially if they're new to surfing. You know, now they can kind of take this on and go, hey, I've been surfing for a couple of years. I can teach you and kind of help these groups. And so that has been kind of a neat transition where we'll have people that have been surfing their whole lives. We have many, you know, adult men and women that have never done anything in the ocean aside from basically swimming. And now they want to learn to surf. And so it's fun to kind of see the progression of, you know, a brand new person, someone that's intermediate, and then someone that's been at it for a couple more years. And so we have a couple different groups of people where there'll be brand new people that are helping them transition. And then there's lots and lots of people that have had some success post-service. And so they can kind of give them advice on how to do things. And really what happens a lot is people kind of teach each other how to navigate the VA, which can be challenging as well. And so all those things really happen. And so now people are not just taking care of themselves, like I said at the beginning, they're getting to focus on others and kind of help others kind of make it through this, which is pretty jarring. Like you said, you know, you used to, you know, being at a fire station or a ladder or a SEAL team, and then you leave service and you're like, oh, what just happened? No, I'm just kidding. I always thought it'd be great to do nothing, but it's not. No, none of us wants to do nothing.
No. Well, it's funny. One of my firefighter friends said that the goal of the whole mental health conversation one day is to not have peer support teams, just go back to talking around the dinner table, you mm-hmm. know, around you know, the beach, whatever it is. And if you look at how we were for the longest time, you know, tribally humans, it was all inbuilt. You know, all the warriors come home and they tell stories around the fire, you know, and there's all this ceremony and, you know, you're trying to pass on to your children. So you're storytelling with that. And with this kind of fractured community that we've arguably devolved from in some point, you know, the goal is ultimately to refine these communities. And I would say that if we did it completely effectively, we wouldn't even need counselors anymore.
Yeah. Just another group of people that have experienced what you have before, and you can just hang out with them and kind of gather some wisdom. Absolutely.
Now, what about from the physical side, the adaptive community? I guess if we're going to find a cloud, a silver lining to the cloud of war, it's that the adaptive community has just, you know, shown us all what is actually possible, you know, from a mindset point of view, from a physical point of view. What are some of the things that have amazed you when it comes to the adaptive surface that you've seen and the technical adaptations they've made on these boards to allow them to surf?
What was kind of the most shocking thing, and it still is today now, is I grew up competitive surfing, or not surfing, but swimming, and then water polo and other sports. And I'm not sure what sports you did. I'm sure you did something as a kid. But, you know, when you'd go to the game or the match or whatever it might be, you spend a lot of time, well, we sit mean mugging, staring down the other guys, trying to intimidate the other team, doing all these things. That doesn't happen at all in adaptive surfing. And I assume the rest of adaptive sport, we get in the water and everyone's trying to help each other. There's different rules when you're in competition, and people actually give up waves to another person just because they want to help them out. When we get to events, people come from other countries and their board was destroyed during travel. It was funny. A couple of years ago, we were in La Jolla, which is a spot in Southern California, in San Diego, and the three Brits that came to surf, all their boards were destroyed. And so everyone else gave them their boards so that they could compete. And so that has been amazing to me, just to see the community and the family, that globally, everyone just helps each other and is just excited when the other person has an amazing session in the water, as compared to what you might see in professional sports where people are angry if they don't win. Everyone's very supportive. So that part has been amazing. Whether it's seeing people that are amputees surfing, people that are blind, there's many blind surfers that have a team that's doing all kinds of amazing things, whistling to them so they can turn, or, you know, people that, one of our guys is a triple amputee. His name's Jose. He's an Army veteran. He has one arm. We've pushed him into waves that I'm scared to surf in, and I'm able-bodied. So it's just amazing to see the things that everyone can do when you have the right mindset. And, you know, especially when you get to represent your country, when we're talking about the world version of these games, it's incredible to see these folks from every country come and just literally put everything on the line to compete. It's fantastic.
I'm an incurable optimistic. I always tell people I'm an angry optimist, but incurable nonetheless, because yeah. I truly staunchly believe that most people are inherently good. And I think if you reflect on the horrors of our history, it's usually, you know, the power hungry, I'd argue the mentally ill few, really, that, you know, cause so much problems, so many problems. When you look back now, obviously you've got such an interesting lens of war, but now you're in this kind of healing domain. What is your perspective on humanity? I mean, you're exposed to athletes from all around the planet. You've worked with soldiers from all around the planet. What is your kind of lens on that concept?
I think everyone's, like you said, is inherently good. It doesn't matter what your culture is. Everyone wants to take care of their family. Everyone wants to be safe. No one wants to get hurt. And everyone is a patriot for whatever country they're from. And so we're all very much the same. And it doesn't change no matter where you go. And then when someone needs help, we help each other. As much as we might be divided on how you sit politically or globally, how people are doing things, when it's person to person, it's very hard to find people that aren't good everywhere.
Well, I was talking to Tulsi Gabbard a while ago, and you know what's interesting about war is there are obviously a lot of people that benefit financially. And to use a different metaphor, if you look at our healthcare or disease management that we've got in America, there's not going to be a push towards making healthy Americans if certain groups are making a lot of money from sick Americans. And it would be the same, you know, in war. Obviously, if there's a lot of people that make weapons and uniforms and MREs and put McDonald's on bases, you know, that's in their best interest economically to keep us at war. Obviously, from a humanitarian point of view, the goal is to avoid war unless absolutely necessary. And I would say that World War II is one of those examples. How do we maintain the checks and balances? How do we work against this being dragged into war and sending our children off and being brought home in flag-draped coffins unless it's absolutely necessary?
I really loved, I wish I could remember the admiral's name, and someone asked him that question, and he said, we should downsize the military so low that in order to go to war, we need to have a draft. And so everyone has to be all in, because otherwise we're just going to keep abusing the small groups of people that volunteer for service, no matter what it is, into doing this over and over and over again. But if everyone has to, you know, pony up, then it's going to be a different story. So I think that's a wonderful answer. You know, if we kept it so small that if we're going to go to war, It has to be in everyone's best interest to go. And so everyone's going to have to pony up, and we're going to have a draft, which is going to cause a lot of angst and anger where I don't care what country you're in, no one wants to do that. So I think that was a wonderful answer. I really liked it. I thought that was really thoughtful that, you know, if it was small enough so that we couldn't keep punishing these same, I shouldn't say punish, keep forcing these same people, small groups to kind of do this for years. I mean, I think that would be an amazing kind of change.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think it's even the same with the first responder professions. Not that we need smaller, but there's a complete opposite impact as far as the priorities. You know, we're out of sight, out of mind, unless, you know, you're the emergency. Now you're screaming for us and asking why it took so long. But when it comes to supporting them and giving them the right manpower and maintaining hiring standards and, you know, equipment and all that kind of thing, we're the bottom of the barrel usually in these county and city, you know, conversations. And I think that doing a similar thing in the first responder professions would be interesting. Like, all right, well, then we'll just go down to everyone has to volunteer to be a firefighter, and we'll see how long it takes for you to actually support us again.
Right. And then you'll stop complaining about people getting retirement benefits too.
Exactly. All right. Well, going back to One More Way for a second, I watched, I don't know if this is a documentary you're referring to, but there was like a 4-minute video on the site, and it shows amputee James kind of getting his board made for him and going out to surf. So talk to me about the board making side. You know, are those people within the companies, or are you getting these incredible board shapers that are working alongside you to try and be part of the difference?
Yeah, great question. So One More Wave's tiny. We don't have a surf shop. We don't make the boards ourselves. We have a shop that we've used from the beginning. And so they'll do that process. But what happens is someone will hop on our website and they'll apply for a grant. And so what happens then is it's me. I talk to every single person. We just kind of vet that they're actually a service member. We haven't had anyone try to fake it for a while, but we did a couple years ago. And so I get to talk to everybody, and then I interview every single person. We talk for about 45 minutes and we decide, hey, are you a good fit? A lot of times people will apply and have never surfed, and they were hoping that we would provide that. One More Wave doesn't teach surfing really. What we do is provide the gear. And so if someone applies and they haven't learned to surf yet, there's just in Southern California as an example, from where I live in San Diego to let's say the north end of Los Angeles, which is Malibu, there's 8 nonprofits that teach first responders and veterans to surf for free. So I'll connect them with those groups. They learn to surf, and then we come back and get gear. So if we're making custom equipment for somebody, we spend a lot of time talking, and then we make the gear at a particular shop here in San Diego. And oftentimes, when you're talking about James is a, I think, below the knee amputee. Sometimes it takes us 3 or 4 or 5 boards to get it right. And that's because when you're missing parts, the boards act a little bit different. Imagine if the weight of your body, if you have legs and if you don't have legs, that your legs weigh a lot. And so that changes the boards. So what happens is we build the boards, but what we do a lot of, and we haven't done it as much lately just because there hasn't been a lot of ask for it, but we do art therapy. And so I'm not a therapist, and I'm definitely not an artist, but we have friends that will do artwork for the boards for people. So it could be Alex, that's the founder of One More Wave. He doesn't do it as much anymore, but we have a couple other artists that will actually meet virtually with the veteran, and they'll come up with whatever it is that person wants. And so it could be something powerful, something they, some friends they lost maybe overseas, or maybe some family members they've lost, or maybe it's their favorite football team. Or their unit, whatever it might be. We've put all kinds of crazy things into boards, whether it's expended rounds from weapons or parts of a vehicle that were exploded when the person was injured overseas. It doesn't matter. We'll go through that process. They are 100% involved in what goes into the artwork. And then we work with the actual shapers, the tradesmen that make the boards to kind of get it right. What we try to do often, especially with adaptive riders, is to get in the water with them first to kind of see what's going to work and what's not going to work. And so that's been one of the more helpful things, is to actually get the person in the water and kind of play around and see what's going to work. And it gives us a chance to see kind of the person's ability to swim in the ocean, because that's going to be a big deal too. So once that process happens, we make the board, we present it. And what we try to do is just keep them surfing as long as they would like to. So we pay for all the repairs. We pay for all the parts they might need. Sometimes we need to upgrade a board depending on a person. So it really just depends on what they need. But the whole process begins with them getting online, applying. They talk to me, and either we'll connect them with an artist, or we'll go right to connecting them with the shapers, and they'll come up with the proper board for them. Hopefully, sometimes it doesn't work and we have to start over, but that's kind of the fun part.
And what are some of the success stories that really kind of stuck out to you?
I think, luckily, probably 12%, 15% at the most of the boards we make are adaptive. The rest are not. So everyone else is getting gear. It's all mental health. Could be depression, anxiety, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, MST, which is military sexual trauma, drug abuse. It could be all kinds of things. And so those are probably who we give more boards to. So anybody that has a disability rating from the VA can apply. So it doesn't, you don't have to be a combat wounded veteran to be availed of our services. So I tell people all the time, it doesn't matter to me personally, if you did 50 trips, 50 deployments to Mogadishu, or you were a fireman in the Air Force and you lived in Kirkland, Washington, it doesn't really matter. There's no scoreboard. So I don't care. So it's same thing if you got kicked out, you know, maybe someone had a rough run on the way out of the service and they actually got kicked out. And so often what happens is then you won't be at any, if you get kicked out of the service, a lot of the services that can come from the Veterans Association, Veterans Administration, get cut away. And so we will give everyone service, whoever, whatever the way they left the service, wherever they served, as long as they're a veteran and they have a disability rating, we're happy to help. I spend a lot of time, going to some of the VA rehab centers and chatting with those cats there, because there's a lot of men and women that kind of have a tough time on the way out of the service. So all those folks are availed of our services too.
I'd never asked anyone in the military about this specifically, but I talked about it in the first responder professions. You know, when we get that angry guy, or, you know, the person who becomes a problem in the uniform, I always ask them, well, what were they like when you hired them? What were they like 5 years in? Oh, they were phenomenal. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, a great leader. But yeah, well, there we go. So was the job a large contributor to this downward spiral? And is, you know, cutting them loose, getting rid of them, the answer? Or could you send them down a healing path and get them back to the person they're supposed to be in the first place? And to think about that on the military point of view, to be have a dishonorable discharge and then all your benefits gone, you know, I wonder how many people we lost because maybe they needed the help more then than ever.
In my opinion, they need more. They need help more than everyone else. This scenario I saw happen several times. So maybe a young Marine on deployment gets blown up several times, gets some traumatic brain injury. It goes undiagnosed. They come back to the U.S. And then they get into trouble. They're late a couple times. They come in smelling like booze. They get a DUI and they go, "You're a piece of crap. I don't care that you served, that you did a good time." And they kick them out. And they're like, And there's so many people that happened to that it's really shocking. And so, and now those guys, not only did they get kicked out of the thing that they were, you know, this family they're part of, now they can get no support. And now they almost are kind of shunned. And so those are the folks that really need a hand. They can just go, "Hey, just come on over. You know, everyone makes mistakes, you know, come on over, let's go surfing. I got it. Yeah, let's do it." And so I think a lot of people really could use that hand. I'm sure that's the same in first responder land, that, you know, the exact same thing could happen and then you just kind of cut off.
Yeah, because it's not even a loss of tribe, it's having your tribe turn their back on you, which, as we know, you know, if you go back a few thousand years, meant death. So we're wired to be part of that tribe, and it's detrimental if we're not.
Right. No, so just seeing that happen over and over again is tragic. So I'm always happy to be able to do that. And what's interesting for us when we started doing the nonprofit world, a lot of the groups will only support people that are post 9/11 and forward, not for any reason other than it's easier and it's a big group, but we've been open to everybody the whole time. And so a couple of years ago, we made a board, I'm not sure which video we saw, for a guy that was in Vietnam. And then, you know, we're giving a board away to somebody that was in Syria. So it's fun to be able to connect the folks that probably feel like they got treated the worst, you know, whether it's Vietnam and on coming back. What we do a lot is try to help people get their VA claims working. A lady that comes and volunteers with us all the time, she's a surfer. Her father was a Vietnam veteran and he had never done a VA claim ever. And then she brought him, she met some of our guys. We bring VA people to our events just to meet and chat with people and let them know what's available. And they did a claim for him and got him back paid and done everything from like 1977 to, you know, this year, which is pretty incredible.
Someone said to me a while ago now, as far as a number of veterans that we're losing, that a large portion was actually our Vietnam vets. And if you look at the homecoming story of a lot of them, it's not ticker tape parades by any means. So you've got, again, that tribe turning their back on you, you know, organizational betrayal in a way. But then a lot of them, you know, went into whatever workforce was, and now they're at retirement age, civilian retirement age. So now they're once again finding themselves, you know, out of this tribe, out of this purpose, and maybe alone in a house. And so, yeah, we should be taking care of the previous generations. I would argue Korea, even though obviously they're pretty old now, you know, the Forgotten War, that's another group that really probably got almost no acknowledgement for their service.
Zero for many, especially, you know, black and brown people. You know, it was horrible back in those days. So it's really heartening to see folks come forward and be able to just point them in the right direction and get some help. So that's been cool.
Now, what about the VA themselves? It's an interesting lens. Obviously, I'm you know, never served in the military myself, but a lot of...
Sure.
Go. But you know, you've talked about all these different progressive elements. My wife actually is about to become an optometrist, doctor of optometry, and she's working in the VA as her last kind of residency year. And I'm hearing phenomenal things about the care these veterans are getting in the one close to me in the villages. So what is the kind of evolution of that? Are we seeing, you know, changes being made so it's becoming more holistic and spreading the toolbox wider so these veterans can find their own unique healing kind of cocktail?
I think so. I think it's still pretty localized. I think in the bigger areas, like for me in San Diego has the largest veteran community in the U.S. I think then it goes to Norfolk and then maybe Oahu. But for here, it's great. There's a lot of things you can do. I think what guys get really angry about is the way we're brought up in the service is if you have an injury, you get hurt or sickness, you don't report it. And so this drags on. And then what happens is now you're out of the service and you'd like to get care for something that is not in your record. Because you were kind of, that's just how it is. You don't do it. And so the frustration can be really high. You go, no, I got hurt doing this thing in the service. Well, you didn't ever report it. And so now there's this fight that happens. I think they're getting better about that. I know for in San Diego, it's much better than in other places. I think smaller places probably have smaller issues or small town type things. But for here, I've definitely noticed it's pretty big. I mean, every time I call and ask them to come, they have outreach folks that will come to every event that I ask them to. And most of the people are all veterans themselves. And so they kind of understand it. So I think it is getting better. There's definitely a long way to go, but it's definitely better. It's not just, when I first retired, they wanted to give me, I think, 14 different types of medications, whether it's sleep or anxiety or depression, whatever it is, there were so many. But now they're trying to not do that, I think, as much as offer all kinds of different, what they call recreational therapy. And the VA actually runs a surf clinic. They run all kinds of stuff. So I think as long as you're willing to put in you do have to put a little bit of work. You have to find it. It's not as easy to kind of navigate as it should be, but it is getting much better, I think.
So aside from your own personal journey with surfing, were there any other tools that have helped you kind of go from that low place and grow yourself?
I think for me, like I mentioned, the volunteering piece was big for me. The community piece of other veterans after service was helpful for me. Helping other people is definitely the big thing for me. And just kind of realizing for me that I found this to be hard for adults, maybe especially males, like it's okay once you're to do things just for fun or just for yourself instead of doing stuff for work or for what you think is you need to do around the house or for your family, just do something that's just fun, just for you, that really gets nothing, really gives nothing to anybody but yourself. I think that was really hard for me. And I think it's really hard for lots of adults, especially males, especially people that come from first responders or military. You're just not used to doing that. You're used to trying to take care of other people. And so doing things just for me really, really helped me and kind of helped me get some peace for sure.
Beautiful. Well, I want to throw some quick closing questions at you before I let you go, if that's okay.
Yeah.
All right. The first one I'd love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
The last one I read, I'm horrible. I don't read very much. I listen to lots of podcasts. But I read Blue Mind, which is pretty good. And that was just kind of how the ocean kind of helps heal people through just contact. And so that was pretty cool. I really like that book.
And what about films or documentaries?
We're talking about surfing stuff. I just watched a cool documentary. I loved, and some people hate it, the one about the octopus. It's called My Teacher, the Octopus. I really enjoyed that. It's a documentary about this guy that follows an octopus around. But something that was really fun was watching the 100 waves, like the biggest waves they're surfing in Portugal right now. This French woman has surfed the biggest wave ever. It's incredible. Her story is fantastic, but it's on HBO right now, or Max, whatever it's called. But it documents the history of the big wave riding in Portugal at Nazaré, which has the biggest waves in the world. Pretty incredible seeing those humans ride down those giant waves.
I've got to go there one day. My mom and my brother live in Portugal. They're from England, but they moved to Portugal. And it's not too far from where they live. So, I mean, just seeing the people watching it, and they just look like ants. It's this freaking wave. It's insane.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, speaking of that, I had Bethany Hamilton on a while ago now, and, you know, watching her, we were talking about amputees with one arm, you know, getting through these waves in the first place, but, you know, riding against the, not even the adaptive, bracket, but just the regular bracket with a single arm. Pro. You talk about defying all, you know, or just reprogramming or recalibrating what is possible. I mean, she is phenomenal. And, you know, obviously she's an advocate for marine wildlife after losing an arm to a shark. So same as Paul de Gelder, another good example.
She's incredible. She has a nonprofit of her own called, what is it called? Perfectly Flawed. And so she takes girls that have similar injuries, or they were born missing parts, and teaches them to surf here in San Diego every year. We volunteer and go do it. Incredible. And then you see Bethany surf and you're like, holy crap, she rips. She's so good at surfing. But what I found was kind of shocking to me. Like, so she brings all these girls, and I think they do boys now. It's called Forged or something. But women and young girls that have those type of injuries or are born with those ailments have a much higher rate of being attacked or assaulted. So they had, as part of their week-long program, they'd stay at the beach, they'd surf, they'd have these IDF Krav Maga chicks come and teach them to fight from like their chair or the crutch or whatever it was. It was incredible to see these girls like learning how to roll and do Krav Maga and how to protect themselves, because they have such a higher rate of being attacked. So it's a really neat program. Bethany's awesome. So I'm stoked. I've been able to volunteer a couple of years with her.
That's amazing. Yeah, I want to get it back on the show at some point. All right. Well, then, speaking of amazing people, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
I do. You should get Jose. Jose is a friend of mine. He's a Jose Martinez. He's a Army veteran, triple amputee, world champion adaptive surfer. He'll make you want to get outside and do something. Just talking to him. He's the most stoked person I've ever met still.
Brilliant. Well, if you're able to help, we'll make that happen, definitely.
For sure.
All right. Well, then the last question before we find out where people can find One More Wave and yourself personally, what do you do to decompress?
I go surfing. I go get in the ocean by myself.
Now, what about, just as a quick side note, when I lived in Huntington for a while, yeah, what they call that, Surf City USA, there was a big controversy as who actually was Surf City USA. But I remember seeing some of the waves were just so crowded. How do you find sections of the ocean so it is therapeutic and not, you know, a big fist fight in the middle of the ocean?
I try to go when the sun's barely coming up, because those guys are usually asleep still. So I try to go very early. We're lucky. We're close to Baja. We can go down into Mexico. You can always find spots where there's nobody else.
Beautiful. All right. Well, then where can people find One More Wave online?
Sure. So we have Instagram. It's just 1MWave, or the website's onemorewave.com. Pretty easy. Just, you'll find us all over the place.
And then so people can apply to actually partake themselves, but also they can donate on there?
They can donate, they can volunteer, they can join a chapter. Chapter is just, you're not joining a gang. We're not going to give you a patch and have to do anything. You just come to these groups. It just means you can come surf and join everybody in the ocean. Everyone's welcome. We're all inclusive. So anybody can come. We're family friendly. So join a chapter, you can volunteer. If you volunteer, we can help you volunteer at one of the competitions. Those are kind of the most rewarding. Go volunteer at some of these adaptive competitions that are here on the West Coast. There's also some all over the place. So we can connect you with all those folks. You can donate. You can follow us on Instagram, whatever your jam is, just come hang out. What I always like to say is, if you have somebody that's struggling, you have a friend, it can be a first responder, it can be a veteran, you know, just reach out. If they don't like surfing, that's okay. I'll connect them with something that they like. I guarantee there's something that they're into. It could be pottery, it could be art, it could be archery, skydiving, hunting child predators. There's all kinds of cool groups you can get be a part of and volunteer with that can give you some new purpose.
Beautiful. And then what about yourself personally? Where are the best places to reach out if someone wanted to?
Sure. You can grab me on Instagram. It's just Rob Garnett.
Fantastic. Well, Rob, I want to say thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation. I mean, obviously your military career in itself, but I'm always enamored by anyone who has served as a profession, but then looks around and realizes that more needs to be done. And so they carry on, even though they've transitioned out. And I think that, you know, what you're doing at One More Wave, it kind of aligns with Surfwell in the UK, which is a bunch of police officers, and what Tom Hewitt's doing, even though he wasn't military specifically. You know, there are answers to so many of the problems. And, you know, some people like to hike, some people like to surf, some people want to skydive, you know, or just be around animals, whatever it is. But to know that these programs are there and people can find the right fit for them, I think is so important. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks, James.